Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Do you want to come and play our quiz? Can you get to number 10? 10 questions loosely connect 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better the job you get, taking your place alongside our listeners and guests. And if you get all 10 right, then you become a Prime Minister. Easy peasy. If you want to come on, email me, matt.chorley@times.radio, with your name and your number, and we'll get you on the radio very soon. Right, coming up on the podcast today, really interesting discussion this. Is the era of cheap over? Whether it's going out, eating out, buying stuff in the shops, have we got to get used to paying more for it? In part because of the pandemic, Brexit, and controls on immigration. Really interesting conversation coming up on that. Is the cost of living about to get more expensive? Before that, though, it's our economist panel. No Danny Finkelstein today, so David Ivanovich is joined by Rachel Cunliffe. Big question of the day, what's the point of manifestos? Do they matter? Ken Clark was saying at the weekend that nobody's ever read a manifesto. It's never made any difference how anyone's voted. But does it matter if the Conservatives promised not to put up a tax and now they are going to break that promise? Does it matter, David?
Well, not really. No, I mean, the thing about manifestos is the kind of idea which is suggested afterwards that they represent a kind of biblical entity, which must be, if you're going to be faithful to your to your particular religion, you have to stick to, otherwise you're a backslider and a heretic. They constitute in some way a contract with the electorate, which the majority of the electors, who of course have never voted for your party in the first place, by the way, this is just a kind of fiction which we maintain, but nevertheless, which they have signed with you and that you must stick, and you're in breach of contract if you don't go for it. It's fairly obvious to any sentient adult that circumstances change and that some promises are more rubbish than others. In general, people vote for parties, do they not, on a whole series of attitudinal grounds. They think they're broadly either the right people to do take us forward, or at least they're not as bad as the wronger people to take us forward, who by since by voting for them you keep those out. And the whole notion that you stick to a manifesto commitment because it is that kind of contract is fictional. And quite, you know, as you quite rightly say, or as you quite rightly quote, most people don't read manifestos anyway and don't know what's in them. So when people say, oh, you're departing from your manifesto, they don't really mean that. They mean something else. Tories mean we don't like tax rises very much, so we're going to pretend it's all about the manifesto, but actually we don't like the policy.
And it's interesting that some of the Conservatives were so cross about the idea of breaking the manifesto, were less keen about adhering to the manifesto when, because of course their manifesto also said, we'll proudly maintain our commitment to spend 0.7% of GNI on foreign aid. The people who are now most cross about the idea of breaking it to put up a tax are actually quite enthusiastic about cutting foreign aid. Rachel, what do you think about the value of manifesto?
Well, it's amnesia, isn't it? The foreign aid cuts versus the tax rises here. Although I have to say, I actually do read manifestos. My favourite one ever is the Monster Raving Loony Party manifesto in 2010, I think, who had introducing a 99p coin and banning wire coat hangers, both of which I could totally get behind. They get tangled up in your cupboard and they rip your clothes and, yeah, totally on board with that.
The leader of the Monster Raving Loony Party lives near me.
Well, what does that say about you?
I don't know. Alan Lord Hope. Wait, but I can't remember his name. Alan, what's it? Wait, you know, Alan Looney Lord Hope or something. Yeah, he's always in our local Wetherspoons.
But back to reality. I think the real problem, and I just do understand that circumstances change. 18 months have obviously not gone the way that voters or politicians planned, and that therefore tweaking your manifesto commitments is absolutely sensible. The issue with this particular plan is that we're talking about whether it's a manifesto breach or not, rather than how justifiable and how much sense does it make on its own merits. And what it basically is let's increase the tax on working people, specifically working people, because national insurance isn't paid by those who are retired. So let's increase the tax on working people in order to protect the property wealth and the inheritances of those who need social care and their children who want to look forward to a nice big inheritance without having it chopped away in order to pay for their parents' social care. So it's basically, let's tax everyone in order to protect the wealth of a few at the top. I don't really care whether that's a manifesto commitment or not. I think it's unjustifiable on its own terms. And that's what I think the MPs arguing against it should be focusing on.
And it was interesting, we were talking about this earlier on with Francis Elliott and Chris Curtis, but the fact that Conservatives breaking it to put up a tax, because it goes against the sort of brand, they will get some credit for taking tough decisions in a way that if the Labour Party did it, David, it would be the obvious, it's the Labour always putting up taxes as the only idea they've got, even though it's basically the same idea, but it's, you know, it's sort of brand and values comes into it.
Well, on the basis that, of course, the Tories are reluctant tax put right. On the same basis, you would imagine that Labour would be unable to make swinging cuts to the NHS because they're always seen as being pro-NHS. I'm not totally sure it works like that. Without getting into the kind of weeds of which bit of the electorate gets taxed and so on, I mean, the government is obviously trying to sell this as being, in the first instance, a tax for the NHS immediately after the pandemic. In other words, something that couldn't possibly have been foreseen. But actually, in that manifesto sits the twin commitments to a major change of social care and not to do anything with taxes. These were never compatible. Whatever combination of things you use in order to fund this, and I completely dispute the notion, by the way, that Rachel seems to put forward there, that the only people who would benefit from this are wealthy people who would otherwise see their money drawn down. That's not quite what it is, but you can certainly argue about the combination of taxes you use and the impact that they would have on the various people. I mean, I would like to see a much more significant increase in inheritance tax. I think that's absolutely logical. If, you know, how much it would raise is another matter. And I would like to see other forms. I probably would like to see an increase in the main rate of income tax and maybe of the top rate as well in order to help fund these things. All those things seem to me to be fair, but let's not make this another kind of generational redistribution problem, because in time, everybody who is paying tax now will actually be stand to either benefit or lose from a social care system that is either improved or has continued to degenerate.
But I suppose the point is that because at the moment, poorer people who don't have loads of savings don't breach the current threshold. They therefore get the state help. So what you're actually doing is helping the people who do have savings and therefore have to work the way. So the main beneficiaries of this plan, both now and in the future, will be those slightly better off people. I suppose that's the
slightly better off is not kind of, you know, the sort of millionaire
class. Yeah.
And I think it's important to understand that.
If I could possibly respond to that, I'm not saying that it's only the very wealthy who will benefit, but it is only people who have assets, and it will be paid for by all working people. You start paying national insurance, you can be earning as little as £7,000 a year. That's less than the state pension age, and you are still paying national insurance. So we're talking about the poorest in society who don't have any assets, who don't have any savings, who don't have property wealth, maybe who are raising children in rental accommodation, paying in order to protect the wealth and the property and the inheritances of everyone, big or small, who has been able to build up assets. And that includes the one-fifth of pensioner households who have assets worth over 1 million. Now, that's not saying all pensioner households are wealthy, but a significant proportion are, a higher proportion than any other demographic group who have those assets. And you are talking about taxing everyone, including the poorest, to subsidise everyone above a certain level, including the wealthiest. And that's why it's regressive.
Well, we'll see exactly how it all pans out when Boris Johnson makes his announcement later on. Let's turn our attention to another long-standing promise from this government to do
something. War with France?
Is it war with France? Exactly right. It's a long-standing promise of all governments, British governments, to be at war with France. Priti Patel has promised many times to get tough on refugees and migrants trying to cross the Channel in small boats. She's threatened to put them on ferries. She's threatened to put them on oil rigs. She's threatened to put them on the Ascension Islands. She's told off TikTok. She's told off Facebook. She's told off the French government. And none of it seems to be working. And now she's having basically tried to bribe the French by giving them money to police the waters to stop people reaching the UK. She's now threatened to take that money away again. It's one of those things that clearly something ought to be done. But maybe there isn't an answer to this. Or maybe of all the people who was going to come up with an answer to this, it's not going to be Priti Patel, Rachel.
I love the fact that this strategy seems to be outsource border security to the French. We can't be bothered to do our own border policing. So let's get the French to do it for us and let's pay them, I think, £54 million. But they won't use the planes that we want them to use because the planes can't fly at night. They won't use the drones that we sent them because they breach French privacy laws. They're not doing what we tell them to do. Unfortunately, we can't really do anything about it, or Priti Patel can't do much about it, because they're not employed by her. They're employed by the French government, which just, I am not a border policing expert, but I just wonder who had the bright idea to let's outsource this to the French. If you're going to spend £54 million on it, and there's a separate question about whether you should be putting money into enforcement or whether you should be putting money into enabling more safe legal routes for people, desperate people, to reach this country. But if you are going to put that money into policing, why not get the British to do it? Am I missing something here?
Well, no, I'm not sure you necessarily are. David, on the sort of the substantive point, offer your... I know you're always on the phone chatting to her anyway. Offer your advice to Priti Patel as to what she should do about this issue.
Yeah, firstly, instead of building it up as a huge problem, build it down as a huge problem and point out the vast majority of asylum seekers don't come here by boat. They probably come by aeroplane. That we don't take a very many asylum seekers anyway, 25,000 a year compared with 112,000 in Germany. So it's not a huge problem from that point of view. That we are seeking to cut the people coming over the Channel because it's dangerous for them, and interdict people, smugglers, because it's bad for them. And to do that, we're going to make it slightly easier for people to come to this country, because then they'll lean on the people smugglers less. Speak nicely to the French, because this is, guess what, an interdependent world where what happens on the borders concerns both sides, not just one side. And finally, if you are going to depend a bit on the French to do something to try and solve your problem for you, probably the worst possible way you could do it is to threaten to take away the money with which you were going to help them do the thing that you wanted to do to help you.
Because it wasn't that long ago that she gave it to, I'm not even sure if they've got the money yet. It was only a few weeks ago, I think they confirmed it. It was something like £54 million.
Can you imagine being the person in the British Embassy who has to deal with this kind of stuff when she sees the front page of the Times saying Priti Patel threatens the French, and they think, what is this woman actually on? I mean, in what universe is this going to help me deal with the French over the question of how to do this? Oh, yeah, plays very well with, you know, certain sorts of voters that the Conservatives like to imagine, you know, whoever we imagine the Red Wall voters to be, this kind of fantasy group, and so on, and plays particularly well with some Conservative MPs and with certain newspapers, but it doesn't work.
I think I can answer the question of what Priti Patel's on. I think it's got to be nitrous oxide, hasn't it, given that that's what she's just introduced an inquiry to look at whether we should ban the least harmful drug in existence. So clearly she's been focusing very hard on that, and I'd like to know what it was that drew her attention to that.
Rachel, what's nitrous oxide like?
You know what? I wouldn't know. Ask me about some other ones.
Let's ask Matt. Matt knows.
I don't know anything. No, it's the laughing gas one, isn't it? It's the one you get for those little silver bottles dotted around.
Well, I don't care if they take them as long as they clear up those silver bubbles which get everywhere.
There you go. That's why Priti Patel is smiling all the time.
Rachel Cunliffe and David Aronovich there. And of course, you can read David in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is the era of cheap over.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now, is life about to get more expensive? Is the era of cheap over? That's a question we're going to discuss for the next half an hour. The truth is that in recent years, we've got used to getting quite a lot for very little. Our supermarkets and sandwich shops are now full of food from all over the world. Maybe you're having an avocado for your lunch or a bit of sushi. It doesn't cost the earth to eat well these days. We've also got used to people coming to our doors with endless boxes full of the plastic bits and pieces that make life a bit easier. It's all thanks to supply chains becoming super efficient and production pitching itself perfectly to cater for desires we didn't even know we had. Life has become full of stuff and it doesn't cost nearly as much as our parents would have had to pay for it. But is that now all under threat? Mounting pressures are building from rising commodity and shipping costs to a shortage of 90,000 HGV drivers over the past 12 months. And without opening an old wound, there's Brexit-related red tape too. In a moment, we're going to hear from some of the businesses on the front line about why they think our prices are heading upwards. But first, let's get the picture from the industry. Carl Monk is Head of Insights at the British Retail Consortium. Hi, Carl.
Morning.
What are your members telling you in terms of at what point do they have to start passing on the increased costs that they're facing?
So it's quite surprising that they haven't already, to be honest, because normally it takes about 7 to 12 months for cost rises within the food supply chains to sort of trickle through into final food shop prices, and around so 12 to 24 months for non-food items like fashion and electronics. But for all accounts, you know, looking at the CPI, so the government information, or looking at our own measures, you know, prices actually only fell year on year in August. So it's it hasn't happened yet. However, all the things you just mentioned, you know, there was already an HGV driver shortage, but that's doubled in the last few months. There are, you know, over Christmas, that's going to sort of come to a head because in December, non-food sales values are about 70% higher. For food, they're about 30% higher. So there's just a lot more volume going through the system, which will be difficult to manage with this shortage. And, you know, and we are seeing sort of spot price rises. So, you know, I think everyone heard about the semiconductor shortage that happened earlier this year. That's begun to filter through as sort of an increase in prices of some electricals. But food prices are still deflationary, however, potentially not for much longer.
Do you think that there will be a permanent shift? Are all the things that we're talking about, whether it is Brexit, whether it is having to pay lorry drivers more, is this era that we've enjoyed of things actually being pretty cheap and convenient, is that going to become a thing of the past, you think?
So you hit the nail on the head by saying, you know, England had some of the sort of most competitive and probably best per capita prices for food in Europe, really. It's been a luxury that perhaps we've taken slightly for granted. And, you know, I think there will be an element of pricing in some of these labour changes. So, you know, Brexit, COVID have resulted in quite significant demographic shifts in the UK. And it is a lot more difficult to get, sort of farm gate labour than it perhaps was previously. There are lots of things that make up price changes. So, you know, labour is one of them. Inflation's a really big one. Obviously, farm gate prices are another. So I guess the question will be really whether we can plug some of these gaps. I mean, it's not just HGV drivers. There was a press release out this morning about there's 100,000 fewer butchers than we need, there's a lot fewer butchers than we need currently, which means that 100,000, carcasses might be destroyed.
I saw that story. This is pigs, isn't it? That there aren't enough people to carve up the carcasses. So they might just all have to be incinerated in the world's sort of biggest barbecue. But then presumably farmers get less money for it because there's less money coming through. So that all has a knock-on effect on the industry. So what does this mean for shoppers? Let's bring in Kate Hardcastle, retail analyst known as the Customer Whisperer. Kate, have we as shoppers, as people who go out and eat or buy food in the supermarket or order things online, have we got to get used to the fact that things are going to be more expensive? And were we wrong to revel in the fact that people were being paid not very much money to do crappy jobs in the past?
I think we have seen a tipping point, which is incredibly interesting, having watched consumers over recent years. Yes, absolutely. There'll always be the bargain hunters. There's always the people who love and celebrate value and perhaps don't want to think about the supply chain element. But I think, as with a lot of things in business, COVID has been a great reawakener of the kind of questions we need to ask as consumers. What is the supply chain to my goods? Where are these items coming from? Who's involved in the provision of it? And what are they being paid? Or where is that material coming from? And I think whether it's ethical or environmental, about wage elements or anything to do with the stakeholders involved with organisations, we are realising that as consumers, we have power. We have power in our purse. And combined, we can start to make change and differences. And we're seeing that across the board. It doesn't matter whether it's retailers getting under pressure to actually come up with clear statements on their environmental issues, or whether they're talking about their work within communities. These retailers are driven, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because they know if they don't actually get on top of that consumer zeitgeist, they might as well give up the fact that there's no point advertising or marketing their business. They have to actually start being authentic.
And is there a world where, because we've still got the same amount of money, in fact, people are going to be paying more tax. So as a result, we become a bit more discerning, and maybe we buy less stuff, but it's a bit nicer. Nicer for us, or nicer for the environment, nicer for the people who are producing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Or indeed, we don't buy at all. So again, in the last 18 months, when you look at the majority of research coming out, people talk about items like fashion, for instance. They've realised perhaps they don't need the amount of items that they've got hanging in a wardrobe. Perhaps their life's going to be different because they're going to be dressing down for the office, or whatever that reason is. We're seeing the recycle market start to come up. We're seeing more people using secondary markets. We're seeing people rent their fashions. And that goes on and on. People are trying to do the right thing, be that their budget, making, as we used to say in Yorkshire, buy cheap, buy twice. But that idea that when we're going to invest, we're going to invest a bit more and make sure that it's come from a good place, it will last longer. But actually, if we don't need to, how can we find that product or service elsewhere without having to pay an extreme price for it? I think this is a seismic shift in terms of consumerism. And it's going to be really interesting how retailers actually start to adapt and evolve to suit it.
Thanks very much. That's Kate Hardcastle there, the Customer Whisperer. What does all this mean then for economics, the big picture? If prices start going up, that feeds into what we call inflation, and then that becomes pressure for interest rates to rise. Here to explain all that, Frank van Leeuwen, an economist at the New Economic Foundation. Hi, Frank.
Hi there, good afternoon, Tim.
Nice to have you with us. Explain, first of all, what we mean by when we talk about inflation, because there's the O&S shopping basket. What actually goes into calculating the price, the cost of living?
So there's lots of different things that actually go into calculating what we refer to as inflation, which effectively means the rate of change in the price of goods and services. And that's what the consumer price index effectively changes. So it basically is measuring how much prices of goods and services are increasing over on a yearly rate or on a monthly rate, effectively. And what we've seen is that the consumer price index more recently climbed to 2.1% in July. It's now hit, and it hit an all-time high of 2.5% in June. And now there's forecasts that they could basically, that prices will increase by possibly 3% towards the end of the year. And this can hit households in the sense that it means that goods and services become more costly. And when you go to the supermarket, it basically hits your purse.
And then when, interest rates at the moment are at historic lows, The target for the Bank of England is inflation of 2%. If inflation, driven by all the things we've just been discussing, does start creeping up to 3% or more, what would the response be from the Bank of England?
So it's really important to say that in some ways the Bank of England is definitely driven by rules, but it also has discretionary decision-making power. And right now, my thinking and everything I've heard is that the Bank of England sees this inflation very much as transitory. That means that you ask these questions about whether this is going to be permanent or temporary, right, at the beginning of your conversations. And what the Bank of England is very much thinking is that these are transient increases in inflation. And that basically comes down to some changes that we've seen post-COVID and because of Brexit. Yes, labor supply side shortages and global bottlenecks. But for all intents and purposes, there's also been a massive adjustment, right? People have spent last year, they've spent lots of money on goods, right? And now they're going out and spending money on having fun, on going out to bars and having drinks and so forth. So that's having a change. The other thing that happened last year, there's a second thing, was that prices went down in a lot of sectors. So a natural thing is that this year, prices will start to come back up. And so there's this natural rebound in the pricing. And the third thing that possibly we should talk about is that there's been lots of pent-up demand over the COVID lockdown period. And so consumers, you know, you got out and how many people went shopping, right? Or went to the high street and started spending. But now all retail services and retail sales data says that demand is effectively decelerating. So for all intents and purposes, a lot of this inflation and increase in prices is thought to be temporary. And the other important thing to say is we have a very nimble and flexible economy. We should have faith in it. It will adjust. Eventually, we will have more HGV drivers and possibly we'll have to pay them a bit more. But then the year after, that doesn't mean that prices will increase. And we have to pay them more, or that there will be supply side bottlenecks in those features. So for all the data is still early, I should stress, but there's nothing to suggest that inflation is accelerating, and that's a permanent feature. So the Bank of England could potentially see this through, and it should see this through for many reasons, because raising interest rates, which is what the Bank of England does to kind of slow down the increase in prices, would be quite catastrophic, given that we haven't really, you know, gotten into an economic recovery just yet. We have a lot of people coming out of the furlough scheme, universal credit. There's the drop in the £20 feature to that, possibly increases in taxes and national insurance contributions. So my suggestion, and I think from all the conversations I've had with people at the Bank of England, is that they're still seeing this as a transitory feature and not to get too excited and thwart the economic
in the long term. Just finally, Frank, Leo's been in touch asking, if wages continue to rise owing to the reduction of cheap overseas labour and other factors, surely this increase in prices will be offset and people who used to be on low wages may have more purchasing power. Does it make a difference that one of the drivers of the increase in prices is to pay people more, so therefore those people have more money in their pockets? Does there end up being an economic positive effect?
No, that's a really great point. And also kind of, I think you alluded to this earlier, we should be really clear that yes, you know, prices in supermarkets, you know, over the last decade were low, but wages and the increase in wages were at, you know, all time low and hadn't been stagnant wages for a decade since the Napoleonic Wars. Now, the idea that if we start kind of increasing demand in the economy, you know, here domestically, then that can be possibly a good thing, because then demand-driven wages can basically not necessarily always be passed on to higher prices, and tighter labor markets can basically generate what's called nominal wage increases, which potentially show up as inflation, but also as faster real wage growth. So yes, we want wages to increase, but we want them to increase faster than higher prices, and that's good for people. And yes, so in some ways, if we start paying people more, then they start spending more, and that gives businesses, you know, more profit. They can then invest, and that will boost the supply of goods and services, and then you can have, you know, some of the beneficial aspects to these types of macroeconomic dynamics.
Frank, thanks for answering that question so well. It was a good question, and I'm now glad that I'm slightly clearer on the answer. Frank van Leeuwen there, who's an economist. Why can't I say the word? Economist at the New Economic Foundation. We'll continue this conversation in a moment, taking a look at whether or not this era of cheap stuff is over, or is it just a temporary blip? Now, we're taking a look at whether or not the era of things being cheap is over. The combination of the pandemic, Brexit, a shortage of lorry drivers is gradually nudging up the price of things. It's something we've discussed quite a lot here in recent weeks here on the show. A week or so ago, we spoke to the Iceland Managing Director, Richard Walker, and I asked him to explain what staffing issues the food industry, the supermarket industry, is facing.
Well, this is, as you said, has been a kind of issue that's been rumbling on for many months now. And the warning bell has been sounded for a long time by manufacturers and suppliers and retailers. And there's a longer kind of systemic issue that the average age of a HGV driver is 57. So it is a bit of a kind of dying industry workforce in that respect. We need to get like younger people into the workforce. And I think in totality, we've got about 100,000 short in this country. So it is a big amount that we're short. And Iceland ourselves, we're short by about 100 full-time HGV drivers. And this is causing problems throughout the food industry. There's obviously been, you know, the issues recently with Nando's and McDonald's. I heard you talk about pigs in blankets earlier, and it is affecting availability at shelf. Exactly right. I mean, longer term, you know, the solution, one of the benefits of Brexit, you might argue, is that, you know, we can backfill all of those vacancies with training up a UK domestic workforce. And with the wage inflation that's coming through the HGV driver industry, it's actually pretty good money. But that'll take time. It'll take 6 months plus to train this workforce, get them their class one licenses. Between now and then, we have Christmas, of course. And I think the only short-term solution is simply to add these HGV drivers onto the government skilled worker list, where EU nationals can be exempt.
That's Richard Walker, the Managing Director of Iceland, speaking to me last week. We've also recently spoken to Peter Kinsella, who manages the Lunya Deli and restaurant in Liverpool. And he told me about how the pandemic had affected his staffing.
We're one post down out of a workforce of close to 80 that we've really struggled to recruit, and that's a senior chef's post. But we always try and carry spare capacity. So we have our own internal relief workforce, really. So if we are down on a site, we can shift people about. But it's a huge issue. And we knew if we'd have been unlucky enough to have lost some of our staff over this last lockdown, we'd be in trouble trying to replace them, because everyone is reporting real difficulties, especially among skilled chefs. There's a huge national shortage. And that's what's been reported. People have found other employment over lockdowns and have decided that they can earn similar money without having to work weekends or their Saturday nights. And hospitality is a fantastic industry to work in. But the personal sacrifice everyone makes really is you don't have the weekends to yourself, and it's hard to have a great social life on a Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday night because most of your mates are at school nights, they're working the next day.
Yeah, now I remember from when I worked on a Sunday newspaper, trying to convince everyone that Monday was really a weekend was a very hard sell. It's a very hard sell.
The challenge for us, has been that, you know, doing new things to get people to stay. You know, we've had this strategy now for the last 6 months, and we'll carry on till next year of getting all of our full-time staff working no more than 40 hours. And it used to be a 48-hour week for a full-timer. And there's a financial cost because people's pay is staying the same, and we're just gradually reducing hours to 40 to try and give people just, you know, a much better home life. And our sense is if people have a much better work-life balance, they'll stay with you. You know, you've got to pay well as well, but it's not just about the pay, it's about everything else that goes with the job.
That was Peter Kinsella. Peter Kinsella, who manages Lunya in Liverpool. Amazing. He's literally given them, in effect, a pay rise, the same amount of money for working fewer hours. Let's now speak to Helen Stevenson, owner of Kettleston Country House. Hi, Helen.
Hi, good morning.
What is Kettleston Country House, first of all? What do you do?
We're a bit everything. We're mainly a wedding venue, but we also act as a bed and breakfast, a restaurant and a bar. So we do a wide selection of events and things like that.
And what Peter was just describing there, does that ring bells with you in terms of finding staff, retaining staff?
Massively. I think furlough gave too much freedom. When we returned at the end of May, I had 3 core staff hand their notices in straight away because they went off to start new businesses or they were getting better pay elsewhere. Staffing has been a real nightmare for us, to the extent that we actually are now only open 4 days a week because I haven't got the staff to be open 7 days a week.
And is that then affected, I suppose, do you get the same number of people coming to you on those 4 days? I mean, that's presumably, you're literally sort of locking the door on income.
Yeah, absolutely. We're losing a lot of income. And it's soul destroying on a daily basis having to turn business away, but I just haven't got the staff to be able to fulfil the service 12 hours a day. It's just not possible for us 7 days a week.
Now, I have to say, looking at your website, I'm not sure that you're necessarily on the cheap end. Anyway, you know, you're not knocking out cheap. But do you think there was an issue of within the hospitality sector? It's not been the most well-paid jobs in the past, and people can go and find more money elsewhere. Are you going to have to pay more people? Does that push up the price?
I have had staff demanding pay rises, but we didn't pay peanuts anyway. Our salaries are very competitive. But when you can go further south and earn double your wage down there, it's hard. So chefs, we've rarely struggled with chefs that have relocated down south because they can double their pay.
Our local pub has struggled to find a chef for the whole summer, and it's sort of very intermittent as to whether or not there's. And just make the case if someone's thinking about why doesn't make the case for going and working in hospitality, because you know, why are people leaving? Yeah, lots of other people love it.
Well, going back to like the weekends and things like that, it is hard to balance a home and social life with working in the hospitality. But for us, we're trying to make it as fun and enjoyable and as flexible as possible. So, for example, if my staff are working on a Saturday, they don't then work on a Sunday. So then it does give them the family life and the social life that we are all craving for. For us, the hospitality industry, it's so rewarding, and hosting weddings and fulfilling celebrations,
It's a nice thing to do. Helen, lovely to speak to you. Helen Stevenson there from Kettleston Country House. But maybe all of the staff, all the chefs have gone off to retrain as lorry drivers, because you can become a millionaire being a lorry driver apparently these days. Let's speak to Duncan Buchanan finally, Policy Director for the Road Haulage Association. Hi, Duncan.
Good morning.
Is that what's happening? Is all this talk of how much you can earn being a lorry driver, people queuing up to be lorry drivers?
Well, there is certainly increases in wage rates for lorry drivers. Some people are, particularly from the retail markets, the supermarkets, they are doing signing on bonuses and various things to backfill. You had you quoted from Iceland earlier on, they have the margin to extend pay quite quickly, whereas other smaller businesses don't quite have the same flexibility. So, yes, we're seeing increases in wage rates. We expect that to continue for the foreseeable future. And what I found interesting about the recent conversations that you've just had is something that we're seeing in road haulage as well, and that is drivers themselves looking at their own work-life balance. They don't want to be working 50 hours, 60 hours a week. They want to have a home life like everyone else. And I think one of the effects of the pandemic is that an awful lot of people have looked at their lives and are thinking in terms of living their life a little bit differently to how they were. And I think the increasing wage rates will give people a few more options. It is an attractive job for many people, being a lorry driver, but it takes 4 to 6 months to train to become a lorry driver. It's a skilled occupation.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, that obviously takes time. I suppose that's the thing, is that when we talk about needing more lorry drivers, if people are going from doing 50 hours a week to 25 hours a week, you literally need twice as many drivers to do the same amount of driving. I suppose that's part of the problem. I just want to ask you, Duncan, because this morning the Lib Dems have put out a press release calling on the government to send in the army to deliver food to supermarkets to plug the gap. Is that something the Road Haulage Association would support?
No. Sending in the army would be an exercise in spin and would be fruitless. There's a couple of thousand qualified army drivers. I would assume that they're already doing things in the army which they are required to do. You can't just bring in the army. Logistics change, supply chains are complicated, skilled setups. You can't just bring in a couple of guys to handle a few boxes out of the back of a truck for a photo opportunity, which is the sort of thing we've seen in the past. Where the army's had a big effect when COVID broke out and sort of around Christmas last year was when they were able to manage the border and help manage the border when we had a crisis when France shut their border. That's when the army was really useful. They have the authority to direct people in this direction or that direction. But in terms of driving lorries, I think that they would probably be counterproductive because it'd be so much time messing around training them to do things that are already being done.
Of course, the big political story of the day is Boris Johnson announcing his plans for a tax rise to pay for social care. What does it all mean? Will it work? One man who's been there and tried to do that is Alastair Burt, a former social care minister, who joins me now.
Well, the first thing to say is it's really good to have a prime minister who's announced a plan, because we've waited 23 years and he's the fifth prime minister that's promised. So I think we should be pleased that there is a plan. In terms of the plan itself, though, I do have concerns that, first of all, he announced that there were going to be changes, but these were not coming into place until 2023. Now, one of our challenges is that we have significant problems in the social care sector absolutely now. So we cannot wait till 2023 until we get some support for the social care sector.
Alastair Burt, you were social care minister in one of those many governments that promised to do something and didn't. You're giving Boris Johnson a round of applause today for grasping the nettle?
I was, and I worked with Martin, and it's nice to hear him on the line again. I am. I've not necessarily been the greatest fan of the Prime Minister for all sorts of reasons, but I do genuinely agree that this was a nettle to be grasped. It has been incredibly easy to push it down the line politically, but it's left a great deal of harm in its wake. And also, I've always been a Tory who recognised that if you're going to do more and there are more people to deal with, you have to pay more and you have to put more money into the system. And an awful lot of people seem to believe that you can get more government but spend either exactly the same or keep cutting it. You can't do it. And social care has suffered hugely from this. I'm sure there are difficult things about where the money is coming from, and that will be a complex issue to sort out. But it's got to come from somewhere. And it seems to me, although we've not had all the details, this is a fair start. And I do agree that it's right that he should have done this. And I welcome what he said.
Yes, in terms of the details, he said that no one earning less than £9,500 will pay anything more. A basic rate taxpayer will pay something like an extra £180 a year, while someone earning over £67,100 will pay something like £715 a year more. This idea of this sort of hypothecated tax, a legally ring-fenced health and social care levy, do you think that's a good idea, Alistair? Maybe this is the only way to get it through for the Conservatives to put up a tax like this by saying it is specifically for the NHS and for social care. But is there a flaw? Is there a problem with hypothecating taxes in this way, Alistair?
Well, in a sense, only superficially. I mean, all money goes into the pot at the end of the day. And if you have a hypothecated tax, it doesn't stop you reducing the amount of overall revenue that goes to a particular service at some stage in the future in order sort of to make up what's been put in through the hypothecated tax. So it's not a simple cure-all. However, in terms of public presentation and having the public understand that this money is going for a particular thing, I think it's quite important. But it may indeed start to open the way, because you can be sure as fate, other people will be coming along behind and asking for hypothecated taxes for all sorts of their favourite interests, I think.
Yeah, he's opened the Pandora's box on that one, possibly. Martin, paint a picture of what it's like in the social care system right now. And I should point out, whenever we discuss this, lots of people message in to point out social care is not just about elderly people. There are lots of children and young adults who are in the care system too. What is the social care system facing right now, and how bad will it get if these changes don't come in before 2023?
Well, I think we should acknowledge the social care system has been on the front line of the pandemic. And I also want to acknowledge how brilliantly the social care workforce has supported people at this really difficult time, whether they're younger people with learning disabilities or older people, whether it's been about care homes or people being supported in their own home. You know, our staff have really stepped up to the plate at this time of crisis. I think one of our challenges now, though, is that a lot of those staff are very burnt out, and we are seeing some significant challenges around how we both recruit and retain our workforce. And I know, working with Alistair, who I have to say was an incredibly committed and very good minister, we all talked about the issue of workforce, and I think it's now become even more acute because of the pandemic. And so we've got to address some of those issues, and I hope the Prime Minister will look at the workforce issues as well as some of the challenges that we face around funding.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget, you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcast from?